I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, I'm glad to be with you this afternoon, Ken.
It's been quite a while now since we explored some of the due diligence items you need to address as a commercial property investor, and it would be worthwhile revisiting the topic. Perhaps you might start by explaining the key areas involved.
Yeah, look, due diligence is an interesting topic, and I don't think people fully appreciate what's involved. And a lot of people set out with a notion that they have to do all their due diligence before they actually start negotiating on the property. And there's a reason why you don't do that. Well, there's a couple of reasons. I'll explain those in a moment. But unless you're intending to bid at an auction or submit a tender, that's not the best way to go. And that's probably the reason I tend to shy away from buying at auction or tender, because effectively the contract, when you sign it, you give away any rights you have to challenge the material or the property as inspected. So it's much better to buy privately, where you can negotiate or add contracts to terms to a contract that provides you with a fair degree of protection. And my attitude has always been with due diligence is that you never dispute things with an owner, a vendor, or their agent. You give them the impression, look, you believe absolutely what they're telling you. However, you just reserve the right, once contracts have been exchanged, to undertake a due diligence for a short period of time, and we'll come to that in a moment. So the purpose of due diligence is to verify that everything you've been told about the property and about the tenant is as you believe it to be, or as it has been represented to you as the property and the deal that you're entering into. So, in essence, you've got three areas: the physical side, the legal side, and the financial side. And all of them have different things that you're going to check and verify. But in essence, those are the three main areas, or the scope of your due diligence that you're going to undertake on the property itself.
Okay. Let's now expand on the physical aspect you need to address.
Well, when it comes to the physical side, there are probably five categories that you look at, and that's the architectural, the structural and civil components, we're talking engineering here, the mechanical services, the electrical services, and then the hydraulics and the fire protection. And so that's really what you're looking to investigate. Now, the first thing, when I submit the proposals on behalf of my clients, I give a shopping list of all the plans and documentation that I require. Now, you don't always get it, but if you don't ask for it, then you certainly won't get it. Some of the buildings, if they're older, may not have those readily available. Other times, you have to go back to the architect. Most purchasers, when they buy a property, have themselves sought out, if not at the time of purchase, afterwards to get some plans relating to the building. Now, these documents include construction documents, building plans, schematics, floor plans, and generally site plans as well. So you've got that. Then you look at the structural side. This comes about mainly through a visual inspection. And during the visual inspection, you look at things like the building facade, any curtain walls, the perimeter walls, the roof plumbing, ramps, stairs, driveways, the entry lobbies, some of the internal walls, the floors, the floor finishes, the ceilings, internal stairways, amenities, kitchenettes, all those sort of components that are, you know, are readily available, and those are the ones that are generally where you're going to identify issues that need to be addressed. So you're looking for things like unreasonable wear and tear. I mean, if a building is 20 years old, yes, there will be some wear and tear that is considered to be normal. But, you know, there may be leaks in the ceilings. There might be some doors that don't close properly. You know, it's a general well-being of the building. When it comes to things like the mechanical services, you want a description, you know, of the whole thing from a working point of view. You need to have the material for the pieces of equipment, the books, the running books. And they have to, in their due diligence, make sure that A, they're operating, and B, they comply with the current standards for the BCA and Australian standards. And as far as electrical services, again, you need to make sure that every mechanical and electrical system is inspected. And that can include the heating, ventilation, air conditioning, plumbing, and all other electrical systems and control. And again, part of that, under the essential services, there'll be reports, regular quarterly reports, as to the maintenance undertaken on the various components. So you can very quickly get a snapshot of where things are. And again, if there's been capital improvements done, you want to cite the documents relating to those improvements, and also then to match those up against the original source documentation for the building when it was constructed. So it's a matter of just looking for inconsistencies. And as I said, you've got your base building information, your architectural plans, elevations, your service documentation, and the manuals and maintenance contracts, just to make sure that the building, having been constructed, has also been physically well maintained.
What about the legal side of things?
Okay, when it comes to legal due diligence, at law, I think solicitors have 21 days to uncover any material discrepancies with the documentation. However, the due diligence goes further than that, because, and that's why we like to make it part of the due diligence study and the period we've got to do that, is because we also need to look at the environmental reports. And these are important, that they're generally called phase one environmental site assessments. And what that does is identify the use of the property and, given its use, the likelihood of any contamination existing on the property. If there is that suggestion, there's generally a further phase two report done where they take spot bores across the property to determine if, and if so, how bad the contamination might be. Now, that's one aspect, and that's important, because most contracts will say that having, once a contract settlement occurs, that you have no rights of recourse to the vendor. So that's why you reserve the right to check that out. And it may be that if it's an industrial property and some of the previous users may have used chemicals, it's wise to, if the vendor hasn't undertaken that report, that you engage someone to do that. Also, zoning compliance. In other words, does the current use of the building comply with the zoning use? There may be some issues that it has a non-conforming use, legitimately, and it's allowed to happen. But what it means is that if that use is no longer an as-of-right use within that zoning, if that use lapses, I think it's for an 18-month period, in other words, it becomes vacant and no similar use is put in, then your non-conforming rights disappear and you are then bound by the current planning or zoning regulations and can only use it, the property, for that type of use. There are also sometimes licenses, permits and certificates that run and related to the operation of the building. And therefore you need to ensure that the property complies and all those certificates are up to date. And then the service contracts between the vendor and the various entities. If you've got a standalone building, things like the air conditioning, lift service and any other regular maintenance, there's generally contracts in place and you want to make sure that they are up to date. And so that, in other words, you may not be running to the end of a five-year contract where there could be some hefty cost increase that when the contract lapses and it's renegotiated that you inherit, even though it's not reflected in the current outgoings. So those are the sort of aspects you need to look at. And it's quite apart from, you know, the title being the correct title. And, I mean, when you're putting together legal documentation, just because it's prepared by a solicitor doesn't mean it's right. And it's quite often that you find that maybe in a strata purchase that the car parks as delineated by the solicitor are not actually the car parks that the vendor is actually selling. So, you know, there are issues like that that need to be investigated, bedded down, and that's why the legal due diligence is a key aspect of everything that is being investigated during that due diligence period.
And I imagine the extent of your financial due diligence will depend upon the size of the property and the number of tenants involved.
Yeah, you're right. The extent of your financial due diligence will depend upon the size of the building and the number of tenants involved. Obviously, if you've got a spread of tenants, like, say, three or more, you need to go into quite some depth into analysing the leases and so forth. I mean, if it's just a single tenant, that's pretty straightforward. That's spelled out, and you make your judgment on that single tenancy. When you have multiple tenants, particularly if you get into a larger building, you've been investing for a few years, you're now buying a multi-million dollar building and it might have 10, 15, 20 tenants in it. So careful analysis that the tenancy schedule actually accords with the lease documentation. And, not that a vendor or a selling agent is trying to mislead you, but sometimes there are innocent mistakes made and you just can't assume that the tenancy schedule as provided to you and as convenient as it is in summarising everything is absolutely correct. And that may be parcel of the legal due diligence because most solicitors will go through and briefly summarise each lease. And so you need to then take that summary and make sure it accords with the tenancy schedule as provided by the selling agent. So, yes, going through the lease documentation is terribly important, understanding, the review mechanisms, the expiry dates, all those sort of things. Also, verifying the outgoings, particularly if you're in charge of the whole building as opposed to being just a strata unit. Because, yes, the leases might provide for the tenant to pay all your outgoings, but actually, the outgoings need to be scrutinised. And again, if you're getting advice from a property consultant going in, you can generally have a yardstick, or they will have a yardstick of how much per square metre the outgoings ought be. And therefore, if they're on target, you're comfortable. If they're considerably higher, you've then got to look at some of the existing contracts with the service providers. Maybe the rate assessments are too high, and you've got to look at ways that you can bring them back to what the norm is for that type of building in that area. So it's just getting a grasp of what makes the building tick and making sure that there are no anomalies. And it's not rocket science, but it's important that you do it. And I said earlier that some people tend to do those sort of investigations before they finalise the commercial terms of the purchase. And if, as I said, if it's auction or tender, you need to do that. But otherwise you don't, because there are costs involved, but the cost of your due diligence is very cheap insurance, particularly if you find out that you shouldn't be buying the building. So I don't like to have, for my clients, those sort of meters ticking over until we've locked down the property, negotiated the terms, executed the contract, and we build in a due diligence period. And I think, as we've discussed in the past, I start asking for 21 business days, which is effectively a month when you take in the weekends. My team that I've got can do it in 7 business days if push comes to shove. Generally, I like to have no less than 10, ideally 14. And so that's enough time for everybody to, without undue haste, to go through and verify what's being presented to us is actually what it is that we're buying. And so by doing it this way, you also have the advantage of getting two bites of the cherry, because if you do all the work beforehand and then start negotiating, the implication is that the price you end up paying reflects what you've discovered as part of your due diligence. Whereas if we negotiate the price, lock it in, then do the due diligence, we may discover something that is an impediment. It may not be a deal breaker, but it's nonetheless a departure from what was represented. And so it gives you the opportunity to go back to the selling agent or the vendor and explain to them that this has been discovered, it's going to cost X dollars to rectify. How do they want to play it? Because under the terms of the due diligence clause, you can walk away from the contract, or certainly the clause that I insert on behalf of my client. So the vendors mentally thought they've sold the property because they've exchanged contracts. They had no idea this was a problem. And so there's a better than even chance, given they've invested time, effort and money in getting to that stage, that they will either rectify the problem prior to settlement or allow for an adjustment to the price at settlement. And so in all the cases where I've found problems, that's been the case. And I mean, there was one even where we found a problem and we negotiated a price, I think, of $7.8 million, and we found a problem that was going to cost $500,000 to rectify. And there was a price adjustment at settlement, so that we ended up buying it for about $7.25 million. So you can see the benefit of undertaking the due diligence, but also the benefit of the timing of doing it after you've exchanged contracts, because you still have the right to walk away. But there's very, in my 40-odd years, I've never had a vendor that hasn't come to the party if there's been a serious impediment. So due diligence is important, and it's something you've got to take very seriously.
I'm glad you were able to cover all of that, because I think it's important for our listeners to understand what needs to take place during a thorough due diligence study.
Yeah, you're right, because this is the chance for you to verify that everything is in order and exactly how the vendor represented it before the contract actually goes unconditional.
Look, thanks, Chris, and I look forward to catching up with you next week.